Hey, podcast listeners, it's Michael Shelley. It's interesting how many coincidences happen, and one happened here was I was listening to some Santo and Johnny music, and I thought, yeah, I wonder if these guys are still alive. I didn't know much about them at all. I'd always thought they were older guys who got into rock and roll tangentially, because so many of their records are sort of borderline, easy listening type of records. And I didn't know much about them. So I did a little research and I found out that they were actually quite the opposite. Quite young guys when they started their career. Only teenagers when Sleepwalk was a number one hit in 1959. And that they were both very much still alive. But Johnny was the only one still working. And it turned out that he had as a gig next week, the 19th of July, depending on when you're listening to this, 2015. And so I thought, oh, perfect time for an interview. A guy's got a gig coming up, and I'm interested. So as I try to do with anybody who's slightly advanced in years, my experience tells me that those folks maybe you should put on tape and not do live. So I got in touch with him. And, of course, this is something he did, which only older people do, is you send them an email, and then instead of responding to the email, they call you back. I can't tell you how many of my guests who are slightly older call me instead of emailing me back. So we spoke. He seemed like a kind of a Brooklyn charmer, and that's what he turned out to be. And I've been experimenting with different ways of recording interviews from home, different ways usually of recording Skype, and there doesn't seem to be a perfect way, and the way I was using cut out on me. And the next few interviews I've done are all recorded at home, and every one of them has some technical problems with it, unfortunately. I think I've got it nailed down now, but so after we lost about 7 minutes of interview where I didn't realize that the thing had stopped recording. So you didn't miss much. I got him to back up on some of it, but one of the things that we refer to later, which he doesn't, you don't hear their initial referral to, is he said that he and his brother Santo would play some songs, learn a song, and then they would do what they called fooling around. He said, we didn't know the term jam, you know, jamming. We would just fool around. And it was their father who sort of said, you know, those are the thing you were fooling around with yesterday. You should remember that. And they could never, they didn't realize what they were doing was writing songs with this fooling around stuff. And they didn't even want to remember the songs the next day. They would just fool around something else. So I guess it was their father who stepped in and said, yeah, let's go back to that one from yesterday. And so they realized they were writing songs. And that's one of the few parts that we missed that I thought was sort of crucial to explain here on the podcast. So that's why it's always good to subscribe to the podcast. You get the story behind the scenes. Anyway, nice guy. Another thing older guys do, which is they ask for a disc, a CD of the interview to be sent to them, which is very sweet. So I did that. I sent him a CD. So here it is, my interview with Johnny Farina of Santo and Johnny. Made some amazing records, and once again, the whole archive of this program is over at wfmu.org/Michael. You can listen to it there with all the Santo and Johnny music, and you can see the list of upcoming guests there as well. There's some great ones. Rick Hall is coming up, and Wyndham Wallace, who wrote a book about Lee Hazelwood, is coming up, and Kim Shattuck from the Muffs, and some other interesting things. Check it out, wfmu.org/Michael. Okay, here he is from Santo and Johnny, the great Johnny Farina. Well, Johnny Farina, welcome to WFMU, and I'm so glad to have you here this morning. One of the great things about your career is you started off so young that, you know, you've been in the business for a really long time, but you're still out there and you're still able to perform. You've got a big coming up in Brooklyn, and I want to talk about that later. But let's talk about the very beginning. You were born in Brooklyn, New York, right?
That's right. Born in Brooklyn, New York. And, you know, as they say, the roots are always in your body. I keep finding myself back in Brooklyn. I was in Brooklyn yesterday. As a matter of fact, I'm involved right now with a couple of movies, and a lot of great things are happening. But let me answer your questions, because I can just keep speaking and speaking. You wouldn't have enough time.
Well, I mean, tell me, what I think you were born in 41. Tell me what life was like growing up in Brooklyn in the 50s.
I can only say it was real. It was real. We had such great times. I think the friendships that were had in those days were so special. We looked forward to seeing our friends every day, and even though we didn't have any money or anything, we used to we would entertain ourselves. We had scooter season. I don't know if you know about that, but we used to get maybe a 2x4 and a skate, and we used the one skate, you know, attach it to the 2x4. Then we would go to the grocery store and get a wooden box and put that on the, you know, nail it to the 2x4, and that would be our scooter. Sometimes we'd get fancy and get a couple of pieces of wood and make handlebars, put corks on them from the bottles, and I don't know if you know about scooter season.
No.
No, we had scooter season, and then we had slingshots. We used to make slingshots. We used to get branches from the trees, you know, and use rubber bands, and we found ways of entertaining ourselves that unfortunate kids today have no idea. We used to play stickball. People, as I said, we had to create our own games. We used to play Johnny on the Pony. Do you know what that is? What game that would be?
No.
You'd get a bunch of people, and maybe five or six, and then you'd have two teams. And one person would run, and then they would jump as high as they could and land on the people, try to break the chain, you know? Mm. And that was called Johnny on the Pony, and we always got the heaviest guy. He would be like the ringer. He'd break the chain. And then if it rained, we'd flip baseball cards, you know? And there were so many things that we did, I mean, that I remember in growing up in Brooklyn that was... it was just great. It was a great time, and we always looked forward to seeing each other. It just it seems to be so different today. People don't have time to do things like that anymore, and everybody's so advanced that everybody is looking at the little screen, walking around, bunking at the buildings, you know?
Well, not everybody knows that Santo and Johnny, the group, are two brothers, and you and Santo are pretty close in age, so I suppose it was fun. You always had at least one guy there to goof off with. When did music come into your guys' life? I mean, do you remember, because you're the perfect age, you know, for Bill Haley or those kind of groups to hit you when you were 13 or 14 years old. Did that kind of rock your world a bit?
The reason that we got interested in music, because it was, I'd have to credit my father. He was stationed in Texas and Oklahoma. He was getting ready to be shipped overseas during the war. And he heard, constantly the country music, but his ear sort of was fascinated by the sound of the steel guitar. And he wrote home to my mom, I want the boys to learn how to play this beautiful instrument. I think it's called Hawaiian guitar or a steel guitar. And the rest is history. You know, we lived in a predominantly Italian-Irish neighborhood, and the only music I heard was mandolins and accordions and acoustic guitars, you know. But it was my dad that inspired my brother and I to play the instrument. We had no idea what a steel guitar was. We were shooting marbles in the street, you know.
Was your dad born in the United States, or was he born in Italy?
He was born in Italy, and he came over to this country when he was 9.
So where do you get a steel guitar in Brooklyn in, 1950-something?
Well, it wasn't that easy, but we found out there was a little music store that was owned by an Italian man, of course. He was so old that he was wearing these things on his shoes. I had no idea what they were. They were like little covers on his shoes. They were spats. That's how old this guy was, you know. And he knew how to convert a regular guitar just by raising the nut. And you can make it sort of acoustic, like a dobro, you know. And so that was our first experience. Of course, then you get you hold a bar, and then you use picks. I use three picks and a bar, And the bar is used to make the frets, because you don't press down, you know, like a regular guitar. The fret is made, well, the fret is there, of course, but the note is made by the, holding the steel in that position. If you are, if you should be a little to the left or a little to the right, you'll be sharp or flat. So it's a very finicky instrument. It's not easy to play, you know.
So how old were you when you first touched one of these things, and who taught you, and how did, between you and Santo, how did it get chosen that you would be the guy who played the steel?
Well, actually, we both played the steel because my father wanted both of us to play it. So we shared that guitar that was converted into a steel guitar. By the time we were able to take a lesson, of course, we didn't take the lesson right away because my father was still in the Army, and money was extremely tight in those days. So we got the guitar from my uncle. It was a Harmony guitar. By accident, my father came home before he even got shipped over. He was injured, and he decided that he would take us for lessons, and he said, listen, it's a lot of money. I believe it was like $3. And he said, I can't afford to spend $6 or $5, but I can spend like $2.50 or $3, and the both of you guys go, and you both take the lesson at the same time, you know, and it'll be 2-for-1. He was pretty cool on that. So we tried to get some lessons from this man, and I would hold the guitar, then Santa would hold the guitar, and then we would go home. But our first lesson was how to hold the picks. Like, really not good lessons at all. Holding the pick and holding the bar, you know, and touching the strings. And anyway, my father really didn't appreciate the lessons too much because we didn't sound like the people that he was listening to. He was listening to country music, and we were just learning the strings. And he thought we would be super in like three lessons, you know. He kept saying, you don't sound like them. And, you know, Santa and I never sounded like anybody. We had our own sound. We developed that because we didn't play country. We were growing up in Brooklyn. We're hearing that all of a sudden the rock and roll, and that's what we're playing on the guitars.
So by 1959, you guys had fooled around a few times and had written some songs, and you were you somehow had a number one hit with Sleepwalk for 2 weeks. Tell me how that came to be.
The point I was that I had to go to shop it around, okay? So I have a list of publishers, and I kept checking out some publishers, and they all had the same story about leaving the disc with them. And I would always say the same thing, I can't do this. So finally, I'm looking and I see Trinity Music, okay? And it was 101 West 55th Street. And I'm looking and I said, wow, Trinity Music, this is like maybe God's telling me I should go there, you know? I'm thinking about the Holy Trinity, okay? So now I go to this office and the door is like slightly open, and as I open the door, this man's about to chew into, look like a pastrami sandwich from where I was sitting, from where I was standing. And I had my head in the door, and he said to me, I know, kid, you have a hit record. See? So and as soon as he said that, I knew that God sent me there. I'm saying, wow, this is the miracle I've been waiting for. I said, well, how do you know that? And he said, because everybody has a hit record. So leave it here. I said, no, you see, I can't leave it here. I can't leave it here. Well, then go. I said, but listen, you're having your lunch now. You're not doing anything. Why don't you? He said, listen, I have to clean my ears. I didn't know what that terminology meant. I said, what do you mean? Your ears are dirty? He said, I have to clean my ears. I've been listening to music all day. I said, listen, you got to listen to this. This is really good. He said, well, leave it. And it's going back and forth. He wants to have his lunch. I said, you know what? You're going to be like the rest of the people from the Brill Building and everything. And when I walk out of here, I'm not even in your office yet. You're going to say one day, when this is a number one record, hey, that kid had that record. And you know what you're going to do? He said, what? I said, you're going to kick yourself in the ass. And you're going to say, I should have listened to that kid. Well, you know what he said? All right, kid, come in, put it on the Victrola. Now, many kids out there, any young people, what is a Victrola, right? But I guess vinyl's coming back, so now they're learning what they, only they call them what, turntables, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, so he had this little junky machine. He had a key on it because the arm was jumping, you know? And so he put that on as a weight. People used to put a penny, they used to put a key. If the arm wasn't balanced right, you know, it wasn't a good machine. But anyway, he listens, and he starts to listen to Sleepwalk. That was the first one, the first cut I let him hear. And the first thing he said was, what kind of sound is that, you know? He said, it's great. I said, ah. He says, well, would you want some of my sandwich? And I said, can I have a pickle? And that was the end of that. He became not only our manager, but he became a dear friend.
And who was that guy?
His name was Ed Burton.
And so he hooks you up with Canadian American Records, which is a record label that didn't have too many big hits. So
they actually didn't have anything, and so we leased the record to them.
And they somehow managed to get it onto the charts. Number one for 2 weeks. I mean, number one is an amazing achievement. For 2 weeks in the United States of America, lots of people bought this record. And one of the things about it, I think, is that it appealed to everybody, young and old, maybe because it was an instrumental.
And that had the power that it didn't matter. Everybody loved the record. I mean, we played to all different audiences. We were like one of the few white acts that played the Apollo Theater, you know?
It actually charted on the R&B charts as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how did you handle life all of a sudden going from, you know, Stickball and Scooters to, you know, number one hit?
Well, you know, something, it was like a whirlwind, you know, and to be playing at the Alan Freed shows, you know, in Brooklyn and to be surrounded by people like Bo Diddley, the Skyliners, the Crests, so many people, Jimmy Clanton, and just like, it was like just a whirlwind. Before you knew it, we were just two guys, you know, Santo and Johnny, just two guys that lived on DeGraw Street in Brooklyn. All of a sudden, now we're famous every place we go. Hey, man, I know you. I said, wow. You know, it's just like, it was just, you know, wonderful. It was a wonderful, you know, gift. It was a wonderful gift to receive at such an early age. And God was good to me, you know.
Yeah, I'm so glad to hear that it was a mostly good experience for you. That's not always the case. Well, we're talking about the fact that it was an instrumental, and one of the things another benefit of that is that there was no lyrics for people not to be able to understand. So this was a lot of your records were hits all over the world. You guys were huge, especially in Italy and Mexico, where you had giant hits. I mean, you guys were giants in Italy, right?
Yeah, right. We were. We were so big that they had comic books at the time. You know, like Tom and Jerry, the cartoon, they had these little mice called like I Topolini, which mean in Italian, that means mice. And Santo and I were little mice, you know. And we had super hits in Italy. Like, there wasn't a house in Italy that didn't have one of our records. And we were on a TV before MTV was here. We were doing films with music in Rome. We were doing little films like you'd have on MTV today. We would dress up in costumes and they'd be playing our music. We had so much success besides Sleepwalk in Italy. Probably the biggest success we had in Italy was Il Padrino, which is The Godfather. Godfather 2 was number one for us for 26 weeks, number one.
That's amazing.
That was amazing. And in Mexico, and that was 73, in Italy. In 1965, we had a song called El Amo, which was really End I Love Her, the Beatles song. Mm. And that was number one for 21 weeks.
That is absolutely mind-blowing.
It is. It is. Yeah. You know, instrumentally, nobody could touch us there, you know. And we had a unique sound, which until today, people do know when they hear the sound, it's the sound. You know, it's not fake. It's real. It's not we don't use any kind of, the only thing I use is a reverb, you know.
Let me remind folks that what we're talking about here is the sound of Santo and Johnny. Folks can get information at santoandjohnny.com, and our guest is Johnny Farina. So you've got a big gig coming up in Brooklyn, back in Brooklyn. You can't get away. July 19th, it's part of this Rebel Nights anniversary. It's a three-night party there called Hula Rock, and they've been putting on great shows in this area for a long time. Folks can get information about this gig at rebelnightnyc.com. And are you excited to be back in Brooklyn playing, and what kind of a gig is it going to be for you?
I am. I'm excited about doing the gig. I have an agent, Brian Donnelly, who got me booked in there. He's probably, when he hears this, he's going to like that his name was mentioned on the radio. But he's a nice guy, and he wanted to book me in Brooklyn again, and he said that he thinks I would do really well in this club. I'll be performing on Sunday, the 19th.
Sunday, July 19th, at the Shop in Brooklyn.
I do look forward to playing in Brooklyn. I haven't played in Brooklyn in years. I don't remember the last time I played in Brooklyn, but I'm looking forward to going there and play.
After Sleepwalk, you guys had a bunch of other records on the charts, and like you said, huge success in Italy and in Mexico and really all over the world.
Yeah.
You ended up making some records, I think, for Imperial. And and then you did sort of adapt your sound. You made all those great Beatle cover records and Beatles
Did. Right,
those are awesome records. I mean, I love those. And you records like the Beatle Stomp and those kind of Beatle tribute instrumentals. And then you kind of got a little more psychedelic with covers of songs like Hush and like that. And Let's Go is one of my favorites in the later 60s. And you guys really kept your career going. And you, your brother retired a while ago, but you've really kept it going. You've put out some solo records, and folks can find information about those on santoandjohnny.com. Yeah, have you ever stopped? I mean, did you have time to raise a family? What else did you do?
I have a family. I have grandchildren. My oldest grandchild he's 26. He's got his own business going. He's a very brilliant guy. My granddaughter, she's 24. She's a school teacher. She's brilliant. And then the youngest one, I guess he's going to be one of these football. I mean, he's such an athlete. Everything he touches, you know, he's brilliant. He doesn't even study. And he passed all his tests with flying colors. He's such a brilliant kid. And then we have my son and his wife, beautiful wife. A baby's going to be coming in September, which I'm excited. We haven't had a baby in the Farina house for the last 17 years. So we're looking forward to that. My wife and I, her name is Rosemary, and we've married over 50 years, and which is a phenomenal record in this business, because most people, you know, they just can't hold it together, you know?
And
she's always been by my side, and she's my first mate.
That's wonderful. So when someone uses one of your songs in a movie, or when they cover your song, did you manage to hold on to the rights to these stuff? Do you still profit from that stuff?
Absolutely. I own half the publishing, you know, and so forth. Yeah.
So how is Santo doing? Are you guys still close?
Yeah, I see him, but, you know, he's sort of like, he's just really, like, really chilling it, you know. He's like, really, since the 70s, he really quieted it down, you know.
Yeah.
He's enjoying retirement.
All right.
Yeah.
So is there, tell me, we're going to end this by playing the record of Sleepwalk. I mean, I know it's a gold record. I know it's been played over a million times on the radio, but it really never gets old. Like you said, it sort of is, you know, it is Santo and Johnny from the first minute. It's such an unusual record, yet it's become such a well-known thing, you know, and when those two things overlap, it's something really special. You know, it's totally familiar to everybody, yet still totally unusual, like from outer space almost. Is the record we all know, is that the same as the demo that you carried around?
Basically it is. It's just a little different. I changed the bridge, you know, because I kept listening to it like I do today. When I'm in my studio and I'm creating music, then I'll listen to a mix, and maybe a week later, if I'm not satisfied, I'll just change a part in it, you know, until it's done. And once it's done, then I don't play them again. It's just like those songs that you mentioned to me, Beatles Stomp, was it, and Let's
yeah.
Go.
Yeah.
I couldn't play those songs. I don't even remember them. I mean, I remember them, but I don't play them. It's like a painter. He paints the painting. It's done. On to the next.
How long did it take to make this record, Sleepwalk?
Not long at all. I mean, after we got the deal, we just went in and cut it. We just did it, and it didn't take long at all. It's not like today, in today's world, that they have so many tracks and everything. We never need that many tracks. You know, it was like two tracks, four tracks in those days, you know. So, you know, it was just like, didn't take long at all. It was just a feeling. It was just, it was magical. You know, it just happened. It was, everything fell into place like it should. And sometimes when you're playing from the heart, that's, you can transmit that. And we were fortunate enough to, like a lot of people, when we used to play the Apollo Theater, they say, man, you guys have soul. You have soul. We were not doo-wop. We were never doo-wop. We were always like R&B, you know? And I think that's why we were so successful, that we when we played, we just played from the heart, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely. Johnny Farina is our guest, santoandjohnny.com. You can see him live, a rare chance to see him in Brooklyn, New York, live July 19th at The Shop, part of Rebel Knight's Hula Rock three-night party. Johnny Farina on the 19th. Check out rebelknightnyc.com or santoandjohnny.com for information. Johnny Farina, this has been really fun. It's just a terrific peek into an interesting guy and some great music. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you, and I hope maybe you can stop by the shop.